So, Emma, have you ever been sent a gift basket? I mean, a basket of gifts, not a basket as a gift, a hamper.
Oh, you mean gift baskets, not gift baskets. Imagine that. Here's an empty basket. Lots of space for all the shits I don't give about you. As for an actual gift basket, I think so. I think you sent me fruits once.
Really? Fruits?
Or was it cookies or something? I can't remember, but whatever it was, that shit was gone pretty quick.
Ugh, I need to stop being nice to you. But no, I'm talking about a gift basket from work.
Oh, probably not. I mean, as you know, I started off as an assistant at the agency we worked at. So I was always the one having to buy those for other people. So the fruit inside those was always forbidden for me.
Aw, poor little schmoopy.
But what do gift baskets or gift baskets have to do with today's episode?
Well, gift baskets are the go-to choice in the corporate world for someone grieving, or for any occasion for that matter. That's what this episode is all about. We're exploring the grief in the corporate world, its effects on people and workplaces, and how we can deal with it in a better way.
Yep. We bitch about how inhuman the corporate world is so often, we figured we'd do a whole episode on it. So here's a story. You lose a loved one, you share this with work, aka the people you spend over 50% of your life with, and you get your 3 bereavement days. When you get back, bam, a basket of flowers is on your desk. Everyone lives happily ever after, apparently.
Right. And look, we're not diminishing flowers or the work colleagues by any means. People are just doing what they think is the right thing to do. There was an organization called Give a Care who actually asked people suffering from breast cancer about what sort of quote-unquote gifts make them feel better. Turns out that a lot of the responses hated the amount of flowers that they'd get. Well, they're not super helpful. So instead, they offer thoughtful but also useful gifts like chemo care packages, candles, and comfort clothes.
That's actually a really good idea.
It's amazing what can happen if you actually think about what people in need want instead of just automatically going for flowers. Also, reminder, flowers kind of die, which when you think about it, it's an odd thing to give someone who's either sick or dealing with grief or someone who just lost a loved one.
That's true. Hey, sorry about your grandma. Here's a bunch of things that are going to wilt and die. Just like your grandma. Whoops.
But these flowers and a couple of bereavement days are all you're going to get before you're pushed back into the corporate machine. And that's what we and our guests want to change.
This one very small size fits all approach just doesn't make sense for grief, personal time off, or anything like that. But laws are laws and corporations are corporations. So what can people do?
Well, in Filotimo Life's corporate training workshops, we actually go through the stages of grief and flexible solutions that employers and people leaders can use to navigate these situations better.
Right. So, while we can't change bereavement-related labor laws overnight, there are still things that organizations and management can do to better support people who are grieving at work, right?
Precisely, my young Padawan. One example we've already talked about is care packages. There is also the option for food delivery subscriptions and grocery store gift cards. Even just in the short term, these help the bereaved alleviate both financial stress and the pressure of figuring out what to eat for dinner. So they at least don't have to worry about that type of stuff. Who wouldn't want to work for a company that does that?
Right. And it's not exactly like it's a big gesture either. It probably costs the same as a bunch of flowers these days. And now you're teaching companies like an expert. Moving on up. Speaking of experts, would you like to tell the lovely listeners about today's guest?
I'd be honored. Today's guest is Sarah Hines. Throughout her career, she provided executive coaching for leaders, and with that has worked to provide executives with a better understanding of how grief shows up at work. Something of an inspiration of mine, as you can tell.
Yeah, I can see why two of you would have a lot to talk about.
Oh yeah. We're on the same brainwave and so many ways, it's a little ridiculous and also kind of impressive, if I do say so myself. Her general take on how we can change our perspectives, like we need to fundamentally create a paradigm shift in how we view grief and everything that comes along with it.
Whoa, don't spoil the episode. Jesus, we're trying to create edutainment here.
Oh, whoops. ADHD gang. Let's see what Sarah has to say. So, Sarah, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
How would you describe your journey into this space? And how was grief advocacy started?
My goodness. It's a long-winded answer, and I forget how much time we have. So it started about 25 years ago, I would say. And I always seemed to be the type of person that ran towards death. And when everybody else was, you know, sat back in shock and awe and didn't want to say anything and didn't want to be a burden. And I always felt that it needed to be cared for, that it was really, it was an important moment to not be alone. And I was lucky to have been taught that firsthand with a friend of mine who was dying of AIDS. And at that time, it was not okay to be gay, and there were no meds to really save lives. Families were disowning people. The community, the gay community, didn't want anything to do with it because they didn't really quite understand it. And I had the honor of sitting bedside for about 5 years with men dying of AIDS. And it was in that really, really turned my head towards grief for the first time. Mm. And that really set me on the path of the lifetime of learning, the apprenticeship with death and grief throughout life. And it has always been a bit of a focus of mine, no matter where I've gone, no matter what I've trained in, no matter what I've done, that has always kind of remained part of the foundation to develop what we're doing now. So I trained as a whole bunch of different things, and that had everything to do with death and grief, but realized that if we weren't holding grief as a skill and holding on to that specifically and weren't good at holding it, death was always going to be painful. It was always going to be hard. It was always not going to be a beautiful moment. And so I really turned my focus to grief, and that led me to grief advocacy, to building what we are today.
I want to jump to one of my questions where you speak to how grief is a skill. You describe it as a skill. What do you mean by this? Can you unravel that a little bit?
Oh, it's a big one. I think every life we've had that everyone has on in this amazing world has grief. Mm-hmm. That in many ways we cannot have gratitude without knowing grief. And just like I believe grief is a skill, it's often easier to relate to the idea that having gratitude is a skill. It takes...
Interesting comparison.
Yeah. It's this idea, right, that we actually have to be present in a moment to understand the weight of what we are carrying or what we are a part of or what we are beholding around us. The sense, in some ways, it's like awe, right? Mm-hmm. To be quite full of awe that we're sitting here having this conversation, that outside I'm hearing, you know, the starts of spring with birds chirping. Isn't that amazing how life is kind of tied to these seasons? And to sit inside of that gratitude takes skill. It takes a listening skill. And I believe the same to be true of grief, that as we travel and journey with grief, and I'd go so far as to say we apprentice with it, that we actually build skill as we go. We know that after our first, when our first one loved one dies, that when the second one happens, that we will come out of it differently. That we will remember the great parts of how lucky we were that we had them in our lives in the first place. And we, in some ways, have a little bit of an understanding that's a little bit more rooted inside of grief because we've experienced loss before. So, and I'm not comparing grief over grief. You know, there's obviously some that are much heavier and they hit you in a whirlwind, no matter how much grief you've experienced in your life, all of it is different to every person. But when I talk about it as a skill set, I do believe it's something we develop, that we hold a little bit differently, and it allows us to be a little bit more present with it, just like we are with gratitude.
I like the comparison to gratitude. And I think, at least for myself, that was a good way to kind of digest that a little bit, because I know for myself, when it comes to being grateful and showing, being thankful for the world around me, I know sometimes that can be super challenging. So it's also just kind of sitting with that discomfort of, oh no, my life is great, and I don't have to feel bad about it type of thing. Would you say that's similar?
Yeah. And to that, like, beautiful little point, right? That work of having to be grateful, right? Mm-hmm. I think we are. I think at the core of who we are as humans, we're grateful people, very grateful people. But I think we're more hopeful than we are grateful.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Right? And I feel like if we could just for one hot second switch those two around, where we're more grateful than we are hopeful.
Appreciating versus, right, grass is greener on the other side type of thing.
You got it. Just a little tiny switch, right? Mm-hmm. The moment we can start being really grateful for what we have right here, right now, being grateful for what we've had in the past, and grateful for experiences that we've experienced, we can then turn around and be hopeful for what's happening in the future. When we are only hopeful and not grateful, we end up spiraling inside of grief in a big way, in a really big way. It's really hard to find gratitude when you don't know how to look for it.
Mm-hmm. As you're speaking, it reminds me of something that you had also mentioned where you discovered that grief is love. A lot of like how you're explaining it right now, it's reminding me of that. And that comes from a period of your life when you were a scholar with Orphan Wisdom.
Yeah.
Orphan Wisdom is considered the home of Stephen Jenkinson's writings and teachings.
Yep.
Can you tell us about Stephen and also your experience with Orphan Wisdom and how that shaped your perspective on grief?
Oh, I wish I could tell you more about Stephen. It's his story. And I can say that it was an honor to be there and to be part of that group, not only to be sitting with Stephen and inside the Orphan Wisdom School, but also sitting with the people that are there and the people that were absorbing information, sometimes in the same way, sometimes in a different way, sometimes with a rise of activism and sometimes with some sweet surrender. And it was that beautiful environment that really was the seed for a lot of my ways inside of viewing death and grief. I had known it was always important, but there was something quite beautiful about those days that really kind of cracked open this idea around hope. And this idea that we've got maybe a bit too much of it in a way that we prioritize it more than everything else. Mm. And it was there that I really kind of sat home with it just a little bit longer than I was actually comfortable with. And I continue to hold on to it, and I continue to learn from it, and I continue to sit inside of everything that it means every day.
Do you feel like that hope kind of comes from a desire, like an avoidance from the conversation?
I don't think so. Avoidance might be the wrong word to me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's hard, right? And it's not that we're avoiding it. We don't know that we need to look for it.
Right.
It's not calling us.
Mm.
Like Maria, you know, when we sit inside of, you know, social media or whatever, it's always about, you know, look for the good, be like hopeful, sending hope. Sending, you know, And it's almost this kind of hashtag happy, like ignore all the things, ignore the haters and just be you. And it, everyone appreciates the butterfly. No one appreciates the caterpillar. The caterpillar does all the damn work.
Yeah. They're the one that transforms into a, they become liquid and transform into a totally different creature.
Right. Right. And I'm not saying willingly, right. But that's their journey. And we don't honor it. We don't honor the caterpillar because in fact, that is where all the beautiful happenings, all the meaning is. Right. And I'm not trying to dismiss the journey of the butterfly. I'm just saying, my God, like we diss caterpillars all the time. It's that same idea, right? We diss the hard stuff.
Part of me feels as if I'm experiencing one of your coaching mentoring sessions right now.
But it, you know, it's sometimes, right? Because it's a big idea to get your head around a little bit. Right? Because we align grief so much with this idea that it's hard and it's bad and it's horrible and it's all of those things, right? You grieve because you loved, to your point.
Yeah.
You were grieving because you loved. How amazing is that?
Yeah.
How amazing is it to be able to love, grieve, and love again? And do it anyway.
Yeah.
That's beauty. That's gratitude. That's not hope that's doing that for you.
How would you describe your personal experience within this space and whether it's like the death education and grief literacy from a personal perspective, like your journey in that area? And then also when it comes to the context of like people, leaders, and corporations, like how do you get them, how do you encourage them to be part of this journey with you?
Yeah. I think my journey has been a culmination of always running towards the hard thing, but also going through this leadership inside of organizations and rising through organizations and getting to the point where I'm in a leadership position. I'm managing people. And that was when my best friend died. And when she died, I'm not going to say it was, you know, dismissed. It certainly wasn't. But it wasn't given the attention it needed inside of the workplace. There you were kind of, you know, patted on the back and saying, you'll get over it. You were patted on the back and saying, stay strong, right? When all you wanted to do was break. And I was leading a team and I had to put up walls, right? I had to put up these really big walls to be able to stay tenacious, to stay strategic, to become their conduit to greater things. That was that I had to put up all the walls around my emotions in order to do that. And what I realized as I kind of continued journeying and getting much deeper into what was needed, I realized that organizations can play a really big part in our healing. And because they also helped create a little bit of the wound.
They right. help create the wound or heal the
wound a little bit, they right? Wound. They helped create yeah. it, right? Because they were asking you to be strong. They were asking you to forego your emotions so that you could lead teams, so that you could, and I was in sales. So it was so you could hit the number.
Oh my God.
So that you could, so you put it all down, right? And, you know, I would be so bold as to say, right, forget it, wipe the tears and keep going. Right. And that's not what they would say to you, but that's the actions that they asked.
It was implied through.
Implied,
yeah. Right? It was implied.
Because organizations don't know any different. We hire leaders because they're that. They're tenacious. They're experienced. They're tenured. They're strategic. We don't hire them because they work well with emotions, because they honor people's place in the team, right? Those softer, and I'm using the bunny ears right now, the softer skill set is not why we hire people. It's the bonus. It's the plus. They also. And so grief advocacy started really inside of healthcare, because there was so, over the course of the pandemic, there has been so much heartbreak, mm-hmm. and there has been so much, there's been trauma, there's been activations. And these people are tired. They're tired. And in some instances, this is the first time they've ever come across a dead body, right? And there was no thought given to what that could be for someone. Wipe your tears and keep going. And you need to collect yourself within the four steps it takes you to go from room to room, right? That mode of pushing emotion down takes on a different meaning when you're talking about the quantity of what they've done over the course of the pandemic. So that's really what has led to my journey inside of corporate while grieving, and how grief advocacy helps organizations today. Yeah.
How do you,
that.
When you're speaking to them, how do you address, because I have friends who are nurses and in healthcare, and they've told me, they've shared their experiences, particularly in general, but also particularly over the last couple of years. Yeah. And I was shocked to learn that there is no specific training, or I want to use the word modules or and whatnot, for them when it comes to learning how to process their own grief, as well as the potential grief of people that they're supporting.
Yeah.
How do you engage the system? I want to say the system. How do you engage the system mm-hmm. that doesn't view this as something that's needed, even for people who are actually handling these situations? Yeah. And then when it comes to the policies that they have in place when it comes to grief, death, and bereavement, what shifts or changes in policies can be implemented to better support these workers who are quote unquote burnt out?
Yeah.
Being resilient in the face of.
It's so hard. I think there's an unknown inside of this. And that is, what is said in the policy book isn't always done. Mm-hmm. Right. I know what our policy is, but we do, you know, X, Y, and Z. Some of the big things around policy change, and it's quite simple, right? When Uncle Joe dies, and Uncle Joe lives in a different state or province or country, you're going to need more time to get there, to help your family, and to get back home.
Yeah.
You're going to need flexibility just in that one simple little piece, because no one lives anymore where they were born, right? Very few people live where they were born, right? Where their family is. A lot of people move away. They move away for work. Look, California is probably filled with people who come from other places for work. They all have to travel to get back to funerals. So if my mom dies, I'm getting on a plane. I'm dealing with all the things I have to do. And I have to get back because my bereavement policy says I should have to.
My comparison is, yeah, when someone, at least in Canada, it's changed now in terms of unpaid time off. But before, pretty much someone dies on a Monday, you're expected back at work on a Friday.
Yeah.
If you can't afford the unpaid 2 days. Yeah, it's mind-blowing.
It's mind-blowing, right? So that, I mean, travel's one, you know, time blocking grief is, or bereavement is an interesting thought, because I feel like if we took time blocks off and we just said, you get a total of 8 days, you take them when you need them. We have mental health days, right? We have sick days. We call them sick days. Mm. If we take the connotation off sick and we say their mental health days or their wellness days, and we use those days as bereavement days, maybe we have policy around that. You can use some of those days to help supplement what we need here.
Right? It also takes into account cultural differences between how people honor the dead and everything. Like, yeah, exactly.
You got it. Right now that, and we're just talking about, and then we rank them, right? Like, you know, if it's your mom, you get a week. And if it's your, you know, your uncle, you get 2 days or something silly like that. But no one knows the relationship between you and your uncle or you and your mother. Right. So this time blocking based on relationship or based on kinship is an interesting one that I think needs to be explored. And the other thing is around, and I'm going to bring it up because it's a big deal for a lot of people, is pet loss. Right? Mm. Pet loss and divorce. Big, big, big things that cloud judgment. And not because we want it to, it's because we don't have a choice. Right? So how do we actually embrace these really big losses in our life and understand that they ebb and flow and they're going to be different for everybody, and our policies need to be as flexible as possible? It's a lot.
It's reframing the narrative. Again, just getting people on board with that conversation and engaging them and having it come to a point of, even if they themselves may process it differently, still respecting that someone else will process it differently.
You got it.
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of leaders understand how to navigate grief. Mm. Because people don't, right? So we built the Leading Through Loss program that kind of helps leaders navigate those conversations a little bit, and how to navigate communications, right? When someone on your team dies, now what? Right? What do you do? How do you support your team members? How do you communicate it? How do you communicate it to your client? All of those meanderings through these moments, most people say to me, well, we'll just keep it short and sweet.
Wait, what?
Most people say,
keep what?
Messaging, right? We'll just keep messaging short and sweet. Take your time. It's all on you. You take your time, right? Team, you can have the day off.
Oh, right? Like putting the onus on them, kind of. Okay.
Right.
Let me know
what you're going to do for them, for the family. I'll be in, right? Instead of leading. Instead of actually coming back into it and saying, this was hard. Mm. And we're going to be doing a hard thing together. Right? They don't take the lead on it. They push it.
I think it's easy for organizations to show up and lead when there's a new popcorn stand in the office or a foosball table or like a tennis table. That's easy there. But to your point, it's the challenging part is having those values show up in moments where it can be challenging or difficult or awkward or uncomfortable.
And Maria, to your point, right? Like it's not just, you know, they can do hard things. They certainly can, right? When your numbers are down and everybody needs to rally to get the numbers up for the quarter, right? They can have those hard conversations. Right? When they need to let somebody go because, you know, the whole team needs something a little bit different, that those conversations are hard, but they can have them. The moment it becomes a very deep emotional conversation that has roots in unresolved issues in their own life, because everyone does, we turn off. And that's where the issue is. It's not that they can't have hard conversations. It's that they can't have hard conversations about things they don't know anything about. Which is, right? And it's sad that we don't know how to have those conversations.
Sarah, we're going to take a very quick break and we will be right back. So, Ammo, thoughts?
Love it. I've actually got a few notes here.
Ooh, yay. What you got?
Okay, number one, as a visual learner and as somebody who's basically just a 31-year-old child, I really appreciated her butterfly comparison. Not to sound like another business bro with a podcast, but before I got into the world of content, I worked on what's called a change and implementation team. So there we would use like a methodology called Lean Six Sigma. And I think we talked about this in a previous episode.
Right. Yes. It's like a psychoanalyst and streamlining process that took from like a manufacturing and applied it to basically every other type of project to make them as efficient as possible or something like that. Sounds very, yeah, sounds very bro-y-esque, to be honest.
Yeah. So as part of that, you have to have a good understanding of what people's natural response is to change and how that slowly evolves. It's called the change curve. And that understanding actually allows for better communication with people or entire teams who are resistant to change. And the change curve was actually invented by
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross to explain the grieving process. Oh my God, our worlds are colliding again.
Destiny. So what I mean to say is Sarah's analogy of a butterfly is basically a much more visual version of that. The metamorphosis that the caterpillar has to go through, representing the chaos and resistance to change, is a necessary part of the process before the butterfly, which is the positive results of said change.
I prefer the butterfly image. Sounds a little less like a bunch of dudes trying to make business processes sound cool. No offense, Emma. No offense.
That's so accurate because in Sigma, they use... Just FYI, this was called Sigma about 20 years ago, not like the new internet Sigma.
Oh, wow. That's so... Yeah.
But basically, they even use martial arts style belts as grades. So like green belt, black belt as different qualifications.
Wow. Like, of course they did. Of course. The internet is also coming full circle with this. But yeah.
Yeah. All right. So what about you? What stuck out for you?
Well, over the last few months, last year, I guess close to a year now at this point, I've been working on my gratitude practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, it's a challenge, folks. It's a challenge out there. I totally get how she can call it a skill, having to remind yourself to be grateful for the moments and experiences that you do have and you do go through. Because yes, we have these toxically positive ideals pushed on us from every which way. And anything otherwise is basically considered quote unquote bad vibes. At the same time, we're expected to just kind of push through stuff and just get over it and carry on.
Yeah. I mean, your grief holds up the progress of the machine. Got to keep pick yourself up and doing stuff.
And just more stuff. We aren't really taught to take a pause and reflect on how life can be in the current moment, whether it's good or bad. We're not really given the time either to do that. And I'm not saying to not acknowledge the shitty moments, which is what I think Sarah was referring to when she said that grief itself is a skill too.
Yeah, that's why I like meditation, right? Taking some time out of the day to be present. And even more importantly than that, acknowledging the fact that you're taking time out to be present before returning to the grind, so to speak.
Right. And people often also view anger as kind of like a negative emotion, but anger can be an emotion that inspires people to jump into action and incite change. All emotions have a place and purpose. We wouldn't have them otherwise.
Well, yeah, it's like that clip we shared on social of Andrew Garfield, I think it was. Mm-hmm. He says something like, "The grief you feel is all the love you were unable to show to someone." So reframing our grief or our anger or our attitude, it's like a habit you have to build and maintain.
Not to promote Marvel here or anything, folks, but I often think of Wanda's quote in WandaVision where it says, "What is grief if not love persevering?"
Good shout. Not that that matters, because immediately in Doctor Strange 2, they turned her into a grief-motivated villain, just completely undoing her character development.
Yeah, honestly, dude, all the growth and peace she seemed to find at the end of the show, and then they did that. I was just like, what is the point of this movie?
Spoiler alert.
Oh, right.
Don't get me wrong.
Whoops.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I love seeing like a malevolent Scarlet Witch. She's super threatening, and the director, Sam Raimi, really leaned on his horror background for parts of the film. You can just tell that a contract was getting a bit too expensive and they just needed a redeeming ending to kill her off.
We could also do an entire episode on just the phases of Wanda's grief and how she moves through each. If there's anyone that can show that grief has the potential to be transformational, it's definitely Wanda.
Well, you know, we'll just shoehorn it into another Death in Disney episode because Disney owns Marvel now.
Wait, does that Does that make Wanda a Disney princess?
Yep. The Scarlet Witch is a Disney princess. It's canon.
Oh, I love it. I love her. Here for it.
But getting us back on topic, what do you think the Avengers bereavement policy looks like?
Well, if death is as temporary in comic books as you say it is, then it's probably not that great.
Yeah, you just got to get death to sign a waiver and email it to Pepper Potts. Anyway, speaking of bereavement leave, should we get into the interview?
Of course, let's do it. All right, we are back. Sarah, so in the beginning of the conversation, you actually mentioned that you spent some time, about 5 years or so, at the bedside of individuals who had AIDS at the peak of the AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that experience and that time in your life and how the trainings either you had before prepared you for that experience?
It was such an important part of my life. And I, you know, you go back and you wish for things. Yeah. And I wish I had held it with a bit of a different reverence. I was young, right? I was early 20s and I was sitting beside people who, you know, were dying and alone. And I think it hardens you a little bit. Mm. I think doing that over and over and over again and seeing, you know, or being there when families don't show up, or, you know, seeing or hearing the voicemails that families left for them, and witnessing their heartbreak was hard. It was really hard. If that wasn't hard enough, I then went from caring home hospice for men with AIDS. I went into home hospice for children, and I spent a few years there as well. And they're years apart in wondering and beauty, those two environments, and both of them created, I think, a love affair for me with the honor of being present at the time of death. I can't think of a more honorable place to be.
I think of how death education, death literacy, there needs to be equity in the conversation. There needs to be like a fair approach to how these conversations are had. And I remember I went to a death cafe, I want to say 2016, 2017.
Yeah.
And there was a lesbian couple that were there. And one of the women had mentioned how her previous partner had passed. And speaking with her, learning how death is not equitable for certain communities. Yeah. It's really not. So I can only imagine how that experience at the peak of like the AIDS crisis and hearing the stories and everything that people were going through, it's like that intersection approach where people, like, we really have to look at the intersectionality when it comes to death and like the politics of the body, the politics of death, because everyone is going to die and everyone is worthy and deserving of a good, wholesome experience, whatever that they deem that for themselves.
That's it.
And then when it comes to the children aspect, again, I can only imagine that experience, like that intersection of assuming or hoping that when someone dies, they're going to be later in life, when the reality is sometimes quite the opposite.
Not true. Yeah. I think, you know, at the time of AIDS, we had a system that the healthcare system was quite charged with negativity and around sexuality, period. Right. I would suggest that perhaps it has as subtly gotten better, but I still think there are significant challenges inside of the healthcare system. And on top of all of that, we also have people that have gone through, as a gay man, as an example, has gone through the repression of that system. So to then give up the most honorable piece of their existence to a system that has railed so hard against them, to me feels really, that's heartbreak, right? That needs to improve in a big way. We need to hold those tender hearts in a different way. And that's why I'm glad people like yourself and others are really kind of holding on to the honor at end of life, because now there is another choice. There is another choice. Yeah.
I had to sit with that gratitude. I was like, can I accept this gratitude? Thank you.
So should. Soak in it, roll around in it for a little bit.
When we were discussing for the preparation of this discussion, you mentioned that there was this intersection of grief and pleasure that you wanted to touch on. Mm-hmm. And a previous guest on the podcast, named Olga Nikolayev, makes mention of pleasure as it comes to her holistic approach to death and end of life care. What are your thoughts on this topic?
I'm so glad you had Olga as a guest.
Are you guys friends?
She's on my team. Yeah.
I am so happy. I'm just learning this now. I love this.
She was a teacher of mine as well. And I'm so honored to be able to circle with her. It's a beautiful thing. So
yes. I love Olga. She was my teacher instructor for the thanatology course. Yeah.
Yes.
Such a small world.
Isn't it?
Such a small world.
But there is, I think, pleasure. Well, let's just call it sex and grief. We don't often hear that together in the same sentence. Finding pleasure while grieving is often very difficult. And some people use it as a way of forgetting, and they go right into it, and it's big, and it becomes a thing, a bit of an addiction. And other people shy away from it for years. And I find women have a tendency, because of past traumas and past stories and the culmination of what makes us women, we have a tendency to shy away from sexuality and from pleasure. And there's something quite beautiful that can happen inside of grief when we do connect to gratitude, when we do understand that connection between grief and love. And if we just hold it, not in our head, but actually feel that in our body for just a minute, and hold grief with love, something magical happens. And I'm not sure pleasure is exactly the word that describes it. Desire comes to the surface a little bit for me as well, but I think it's different for everybody. Yeah. But there's something quite beautiful and loving and that comes from those moments that... And it's where pleasure exists. It exists in that same space. If we can just get behind it a little bit and hold it in the hands that, in grateful hands, right? There's something quite beautiful about it that I love to be able to sit inside of that love for myself, for the relations that I've had in the past, for the people I know that won't be with me forever, and know that my pleasure time with them is everything.
Yeah.
It's everything. Yeah. Every minute, every day.
The enjoyment and like the appreciation of what you were able to experience.
That's it.
Yeah.
You know, they say, you know, a really great, beautiful moment for a mom, as an example, or a dad, is to feel the weight of your child on your knee. Feel the weight of their child on your knee, right? And hold that. And hold that for a while. And what does that conjure in you? Like, it brings me to tears a little bit. Mm. It's like the weight of your baby on your knee. Now imagine a mother who's lost her baby and the loss of that weight. And that gives you a really good sense of this idea of pleasure and grief. I want to feel that weight again. And we're sitting there with the weight of that baby on our lap and giving it no mind. Gratitude over hope.
Also, there's an element of meditation practice almost, or being present in the moment, it sounds like.
Right. And yeah. Maria, you know, that's gratitude, right? Yeah. When you can sit in awe of where you are right in this moment, of everything you've created, of everything that's brought you to this point. No wonder we grieve. Of course we grieve. It's worth grieving, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I have one last question, and depending on how people take it, people either love it or hate it, strongly dislike. How do you want to be remembered? It's the best reaction I think I've had.
I hope I'm remembered, and here's hope. I hope I am remembered for always having good questions, for always being a bit of a jerk, for being the one that pokes the bear a little bit more, right? I want to be the one that's like, oh God, she wouldn't let it go, right? Why did she always keep going? And then I want to be known for the one that held it in the love that it all needed to be held, in the reverence that it deserved, and with a little touch of crazy. I love the idea of it being a little, the cackling of Sarah in the background, right? I love the idea that my kids will remember eating something, and when they pop it in their mouth, they will hear my cackle in the background. That to me is a good one. I want that. That's how I want to be remembered. And I think more importantly, overall, the inside of that question, the question of what will they do with it comes up for me in a big way, right? Because that's where your legacy lives. It's not so much on what I want, it's but what they do with what I leave, that to me feels like the real question.
The ripple effect. Of yeah. Sarah.
That's it.
Coming to a theater near you.
Of you. Of you. The ripple effect of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can attest to your wonderful laugh.
Thanks.
And also your ability to ask good questions and poking the bear in, I wouldn't use the word jerk.
Thank you. I like it. I like the fact that it kind of shakes, it rattles you a little bit. It makes you pay attention a little, right? You're so good at pulling all of this stuff together. I've sat with you a few times, and luckily I have sat with you a few times, and you've always left me dreaming of possibility. You've always left me hoping, and you've always left me with some curiosity. So I'm really grateful for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining this call, having this conversation with me, and honestly being such an incredible mentor.
I'm really glad to be apprenticing with this journey and learning along the way. Thank you.
Her experience supporting the LGBTQ+ community and those impacted by HIV and AIDS is incredible.
Yeah, especially at a time where the world had less knowledge about it and such a stigma too. Like, one clip that really makes me angry is, it's from the 80s of the White House's acting press spokesman laughing off the AIDS epidemic when the reporter asked him about it and like about Reagan's lack of action.
It's honestly so like disgusting and like also kind of insecure. He's like, basically was something along the lines of like, I'm not worried because I'm not gay. Are you? It's like, what?
Yeah. Nothing says I'm straight like laughing off the deaths of gay people. Plus, the rate of HIV infections is now basically equal to the same as gay or bisexual men.
If only the heteros had taken it more seriously back in the 80s.
Well, now that it's affecting more straight men, they'll probably want to do something about it now. Interesting how that works, isn't it?
Yeah. The unresolved grief in the LGBTQ plus community is just also awful. Remember us touching on deaths that take place in the LGBTQ community and how trans people are buried under dead names sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
Similarly to other cultural factors of grief, we need to apply an intersectional lens when it comes to understanding how different groups of people experience grief. Because, as we just discussed, different groups have very different histories and lived experiences. Like most things, it's the result of how society views a group of people and the resources that are available to them.
Right, so that would mean creating grief support specifically for LGBTQ plus individuals, right?
Yes, absolutely. Oftentimes, disenfranchised grief is felt within the LGBTQ plus communities, and that needs to be taken into account when wanting to navigate how to best support someone whose loved one just died, because these are important factors to consider.
Right. But then how's disenfranchised grief different to like regular off-the-shelf grief?
So the best way to explain disenfranchised grief is that it's the grief one experiences is not seen as legitimate, quote unquote, by society. A death can be seen as too small or the relationship too distant or in some cases not taken as seriously. So when one grieves, it's invalidated by society.
Okay, so in this context, though, the grief experienced by LGBTQ plus people is seen as invalid or lesser to other types. So then that community, the LGBTQ plus community, has to deal with that on top of their grief. And then that's without factoring in all of the historical stuff too.
Yep, exactly. And now that's not to say that disenfranchised grief isn't experienced by other communities or for straight people, for example. It's just important to know and acknowledge what may be impacting one group more over another. Another example is how in the Black community, deaths due to police brutality carry not just the grief of an unlawful loss of life, but a constant reminder of a corrupt police force.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this could be an entire episode by itself, intersectional grief.
Oh yeah, definitely. For now, we're going to link a few resources in the show notes for people to reference if anyone is looking for additional material.
Mm-hmm. Right, so back to the context of the workplace.
Yes, in the workplace, people and organizations need to be trained to recognize these external factors and differences when it comes to grief, which is why Sarah's call to remove the grief, quote unquote, time block we currently operate under is so important.
Yeah, I think she puts it well as a time block because we've talked about it. We just never referenced it as a time block, right? Like some sort of allocated calendar space. It's, I don't know, it just works really well.
Yeah, it's like, here's your mandated 3 days to cry, paid. And here's a few more unpaid days, which, to be honest, who can afford to take unpaid time off these days? And what's even more frustrating is that, like with a lot of productivity-focused processes, this short-term thinking actually hurts businesses more in the long term. Companies don't realize the actual profits that they're losing when they take these short-term, cost-effective routes to navigate bereavement and general mental wellness either. It leads to less productivity, less employee engagement, higher staff turnover, more resentment.
Right. But these short-term results to them mean bigger short-term profits. And those long-term issues are either the next guy's problem or solved with another round of layoffs. We know how these companies work.
Precisely. Want to move on before I get too angry?
Yeah, please. My fight or flight response was about to kick in.
Let's forget about all the ways that the corporate world is horribly broken, and let's do some trivia. Welcome to contestant number one, Ammo.
Number one, there's literally no other contestants.
Good point. Are you ready for the first question?
I am indeed. I've been listening intently. I am ready.
All right. For your first question, we're talking about emotions.
Well, it's over. Not my strong suit, but let's do it anyway.
According to the LeMaid Institute, which works to deliver employee experience research to help improve people and business results, so you know they're legit, What's the percentage of workers who say that when they feel cared for, they plan to stay with their companies for 3 or more years? Is it 50%, 60%, or 70%?
So as you know, I usually go for the highest number on these questions because we live in a dystopia. But this question's about good workplaces, and 70% feels way too high.
We're going to need an answer here.
50. I'm going to go with 50.
Oh, you would be mistaken, my friend. The correct answer was actually 60%.
Who would have known that showing that you genuinely care for people would mean that those same people would want to stick around? Wow.
All right. Your next question is about productivity loss.
We are the wrong two ADHD-ass having people to be talking about productivity loss.
Real, recognize real. In US dollars, how much is lost annually in productivity within companies associated with grief and bereavement?
$1 billion.
Is it $25 billion, $75 billion, or $95
billion? I want to say the high number again, but $95 billion is a lot.
How much is it?
Enough to buy at least 4 eggs.
I mean, because you included at least, you're technically correct there.
There it is, my gravestone. Here lies Ammo. He was technically correct.
Beautiful, beautiful.
I'm going to go with, was it 75 billion, yeah? 75, because I think the 95 you put in there is a fake out after the last one.
Damn, you read me like a book sometimes. That's correct.
That's a lot of money. Where is this stat from?
It's from SHRM, from an article that speaks to the impacts of grief in the workplace. It's actually pretty incredible when you break down the real life impacts of grief in a language people in power actually understand, which is money.
Yeah, and yet here we are. All right, hit me with the next one.
Okay, so this is a bit of a trick question too. When we first started the show, we looked at how many days of bereavement leave employees are entitled to in Canada. So we're going to come back to that question.
Well, the fact that we're coming back to this leads me to believe that it's changed, and not for the better. Well, it used to be 3 paid, 2 unpaid, right?
And you're sure that's your final answer?
No, I don't like that tone.
You would have been correct, but now you're wrong.
So did it change then?
Well, it depends on your definition of change, but from, I guess, a policy standpoint, it did. It's that typical performative change that looks super good on paper, but in reality doesn't actually change anything.
Yes, the neoliberal signature move. So what did they change it to?
Well, before it was 3 paid and 2 unpaid, totaling 5 days. Now it's up to 10 days total, but still only 3 of those are paid.
So it's still 3 paid bereavement days. So the Canadian federal government has shirked this burden, basically, from themselves onto employers. Like, no employer is actually going to pay more than they legally have to. As we've said, unpaid leave is hardly leave because you're risking your livelihood.
Yep, so basically nothing has changed. It's still 3 paid bereavement days. That's it.
Well, yeah, except now Justin Trudeau has a lovely little PR boost about him raising bereavement leave to 10 days, which is technically the truth. It's slimy, though.
Technically the truth? That should be neoliberalism's tagline.
Yeah, remove it from my gravestone and put it on there.
Now, don't get me wrong. It depends on your definition. Part of me is glad that it's a step in the right direction, but it's just like...
a step for ants. It's a political move, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so I think I've got one more question in me before I retire to my castle.
All right. So, on average, when someone dies, how many close family members does that person leave behind to grieve?
Is this another trick? How does this tie into the corporate world?
Don't worry, I'm weaving a story here. It'll check out.
Okay, well, I mean, it depends on the person, on the impact they had, right?
So is it 3 people, 5 people, or 9 people on average for the average folk out there?
9? I'm going with 9 because that still seems kind of low. But then I'm brown, so my close family count is in the thousands.
Well, that stat is actually from an article that was doing the rounds during the peak of COVID. But I think it's important to consider the impact of a single death on a larger number of people. We touch a lot of people's lives without really realizing it. And yes, 9 is correct. We'll add the study and article into the show notes.
Okay, so that's how that ties into bereavement. The number impacted, I guess.
Yes, exactly. This hidden impact of grief is much, much wider than we think it is. Let us show you. Think of grief as like a virus, too. If one person dies, on average, that grief infects 9 close people each time. So let's look at that in the context of a populous country that lost a lot of people to COVID, the US.
Mm-hmm.
In the US, in 2021, there were roughly 868,000 deaths attributed to COVID alone. Just COVID. Using this 9 close family members impacted stat, that translates to 7.8 million loved ones that are actively grieving. Most of them are in the workplace.
Shit. And that's just the close ones too. So the idea that you have this hidden or invisible impact of grief on economies, workplaces, all of that's like really true.
Right? So when we look at the GDP in December 2020 in the US, it was 20.94 trillion. In December 2021, there were approximately 157 million workers in the US. If we assume that all 7.8 million people who are grieving are workers, that implies that close to 5% of all employees in the US have been grieving the loss of a loved one just due to COVID alone, not including the other top killers like heart disease and cancer.
Wow, you did the math. I mean, I didn't even want to calculate those numbers, man. That's a lot of grief.
Yeah, man, I put in the work. Lovely stuff, isn't it? So before we sign off, you were telling me you have some stories to share?
Mm-hmm. So for this episode, I was researching corporate bereavement related topics, and I stumbled upon a list of just some of the most incredible horror stories.
Oh God, is this one of those I have a shitty boss kind of things?
Yeah, exactly. So while they were going through the worst time of their lives and losing a loved one, their bosses did this. So I have some anecdotes here about how terrible corporate culture made it even worse for them.
Oh no. I don't know if I want to be any more angry with the corporate world than I already am.
Trust me, you want to hear this. It's horrendous. And also a reminder for workers and unions to stand up for each other, because clearly some workplaces don't care about you.
A Philotima Life story time. Let's hear it.
This one is called, My Boss Made Me Leave a Work-Related Note at the Grave of My Bereaved Co-Worker's Relative. That's the
what
title.
What the fuck?
That's the title. Yeah. So here it goes. 3 weeks ago, one of my co-workers lost a relative. She has been off work on bereavement and family leave. Our boss isn't happy with her being off for so long. Since it's out of his control, he doesn't get to approve or deny her leave in this case. The HR department is in charge of that. I have been doing my best to ignore him whenever he complains.
He's complaining. Why did they die? Oh my God.
Last week, my boss gave me an envelope with my co-worker's name on it and told me to leave it at the grave of my co-worker's relative. He said at first it was a condolence card, but I didn't buy it because our work had already sent a card. When I asked him about it again, he said it was a note with some work-related items only she knows about and he needs answers ASAP. And she also won't answer her personal, not work phone, when he calls her. He even gave me directions to the cemetery and everything.
That is like the level of dedication to like find out where the cemetery is, like the plot, like just there's so much wrong with this.
Yeah. The boss could have put that much effort into being not a dickhead. It's just so offensively careless that it's almost impressive. Like we've somehow raised people that think like computers without any shred of empathy.
Did you recently see that robot that worked for like 20 minutes? And then after working for 20 minutes, it just completely shut itself down because it was like, this is the better option for me. Like even robots know, you know, like.
Was it in Japan?
I don't know. I just remember watching the robot collapse and being like, yeah, I get it. I get it.
So, same, bro. Yeah.
Like, how do you think as a human that this is a good idea to do though? Like, how did you get to this point in your life?
Lots of poor choices. And for some reason, I think those shirts with the little pocket on the chest, I don't know why, I really hate those. And I thought I was better.
Well, compared to this, you've turned out pretty great. So shout out to your mom.
Clip it. She said it, not me. Clip it, Stacey.
Comparatively, don't push it.
Never mind.
All right. Well, between the 7.8 million people grieving and the insensitive dude asking his employees to harass another employee at the cemetery, I think this is a good place to end this episode. I might need a drink.
Yeah, agreed. Remember, people, look out for yourselves. Look out for your coworkers. We can assure you that the people you work for and the government, they don't care.
On a lighter note, listeners, feel free to send us your absolutely horrid stories when it comes to bereaved experiences at work.
Yes, please send. We'll name and shame, and we'll make sure they appear on future episodes.
Yes, a little Filotuma Life listener story time.
Love to hear it.
Till next time.
It's bye from Amo and Maria.
But not forever.